Speaking on the program at this time is Brother James W. Boyd.
1 Kings tells us of the closing days of the reign of that great King David. It also tells us of the glorious reign of Solomon, but of the sad division that occurred in the nation of Israel, the dividing into two kingdoms, the two tribes of the south called Judah, the 10 tribes of the north being called northern Israel. In the last days of David's reign, most of which is recorded for us in 2 Samuel, there was an attempt by another son of David to take the throne away from him prematurely. This man was named Adonijah. He decided, even before David was dead, that he would declare himself to be king and made arrangements to that end. Seeing that this was about to transpire, Bathsheba and Nathan came before David, one at a time, to remind him that he had promised that Solomon was going to be the king. Now, it was not only his promise, but this was God's intent. But it looked like that all of that was going to be aborted by the things that Adonijah was accomplishing, because he had his followers, he had already engaged in a great celebration. It looked like he was about to be coronated as the king. So even though David was on his, literally, on his deathbed, he still had his mentality and his wits about him. And he told his officers and his immediate subordinates to take Solomon, to put him on the king's mule, to take him through the city, to declare him to be the king, and to go even so far as to put him on the throne. And this they did, even as Adonijah and his close associates were celebrating what they thought would be his impending kingship. Well, when it was noised abroad among Adonijah and his friends of the things that David had done concerning Solomon, why, Adonijah very quickly conceded and surrendered his attempt to become the next king. In 1 Kings chapter 2, verses 2 and 3, we have some great and powerful and wonderful words of admonition that David gave to his son Solomon as Solomon was about to become king. He said, "I go the way of all the earth. Be thou strong, therefore, and show thyself a man." I don't know how we could emphasize that last phrase that I mentioned to you too much. What marvelous instruction for a father to give to his son. I don't care what he was getting ready to do. You be strong, and you show yourself a man. And keep the charge of the Lord thy God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes and his commandments, and his judgments and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that thou mayest prosper in all that thou doest, and whithersoever thou turnest thyself. Brethren, those of us who are privileged to be fathers, and if we are blessed to have sons, I doubt that there's any words of wisdom that would be more appropriate than to speak such sentiments to our children and to our sons, particularly, than that which David uttered to Solomon. As we continue to read of the admonitions of David to his son, David gave certain instructions to Solomon as to how to deal with certain people that David, in his experience, realized would be potential hazards and threats to Solomon. Men like Joab, who had been David's captain of his army through the years, but with whom he had had many differences. Abiathar, the high priest, very influential man, but who had betrayed David. And there were others he gave instructions as to how to deal with them. And so in the early chapters of 1 Kings, we have recorded the death of David and Solomon assuming power. And so comes to an end what is certainly one of the most illustrious careers of which we read in Scripture. Everybody that studies the Bible lifts the name of Abraham and the name of Moses, but they also uphold that great name of David because he was a most unique and generally godly man. But as he said, he would go the way of all the earth. His time of service had ended. So it became the task of Solomon to establish himself on the throne, and this he did, and he suppressed the potential foes that he had. Adonijah, Abiathar, Joab, he disposed of them, he killed some, he banished others, he took others out of power, and he often did it, what at least seems to me, on the basis of some of the most flimsy excuses, just the slightest little old thing, he seized upon it to crush those who might have sometime, potentially at least, proved to be a threat to him. Solomon is credited, however, for having made a most intelligent request as he became king. A request to God that he might have wisdom to rule and to judge his people correctly. And this ought to be the ambition of anybody who assumes any sort of leadership role, and whether it's of the nation, of the church, of the family, of the school, or wherever, or business, to be able to rule and to lead wisely. Now, Solomon has been given a lot of credit for having made that request. He does deserve some credit, but that's not why he deserves the credit. God, in a vision, taught Solomon to make that kind of request. Solomon does, however, deserve credit for being taught and listening to the teaching, and then having been taught to ask for wisdom, to ask for wisdom, and this God gave unto him. I think it's proper to characterize the reign of Solomon as being one of peace, one of prosperity. He was certainly a reign of fame and of power and of wisdom and of wealth. We possibly do not give sufficient credit to David for having made this possible for Solomon and his rule. If it had not been for David and his military conquests, if it had not been for David to make Israel the dominant power in the area, Solomon could not have enjoyed all the abundance of things that he did enjoy. But because of his illustrious father, he inherits a nation and a kingdom that was united, that he made wealthy, and by his wisdom he ruled in such a majestic fashion. And his fame and his wisdom was spread abroad. We read about visits that he had from dignitaries from other nations, such as the Queen of the South, the Queen of Sheba, who came to behold all of the wealth and the wisdom of Solomon. And when it was displayed to her, her comment was, "The half was not told me." And I suppose every Bible student is familiar with that great demonstration of his wisdom and his cunning and his ability and his perception. When it was brought before his court, two women that were disputing over a child. These two women lived in the same house. They both had children, having been delivered about the same time. In the course of one night, one woman overlaid her child and the child died. But during the night, before the other one awoke, she switched the children, took the live one to herself, left the dead child beside the other mother. When the morning came, and time to nurse the baby, the mother obviously recognized this was not her child. And so the matter was brought before Solomon. To whom did the child belong? Well, as Solomon listened to the story of both of them claiming that the dead child belonged to the other, both of them claiming that the live child belonged to them, Solomon commanded that the child be cut in two with a sword, half given to one and half given to another. Whereupon, the true mother objected quickly. She was quite willing for the child to be given to the other mother rather than to see that child die. Whereas the other mother was willing for the child to die. And that, of course, betrayed who was the real mother. And so Solomon awarded the real mother with the child, which properly belonged to her. And such were characteristics of his great wisdom. One of the real accomplishments of Solomon during his reign is also recorded for us here in 1 Kings, and that was the construction of that great and grand and glorious temple. The temple that David had desired to build, had wanted to build, was denied to build, but many of the supplies for which he did accumulate. And as Solomon began the construction on this temple, as David had been told he would be able to do, even some of the neighboring nations, even some of the heathen and pagan nations, assisted him in furnishing certain things that were necessary and cooperated in the work, which in itself is a notable thing because it reveals the extent of the influence and the power as well as the respect that Solomon commanded in all the region, that even those who were not of the true and living God would be willing to help Solomon do something to glorify his God. And this temple was most elaborate, as you read here in 1 Kings, of all of the ornaments and how richly it was done. It was a magnificent and a beautiful edifice. The finest of woods, the finest of materials, overlaid with gold. It took 7 years and literally thousands of people working during those 7 years to erect this temple. And it was financed by heavy levies and taxes upon the people, but also from tributes that he commanded and extracted from nearby nations. And when came time for the dedication of this temple, we have seen something here that is so significant and characteristic of Solomon and his reign. It was a most elaborate dedication ceremony and a tremendous extended days of feasting. And thousands upon thousands of animals were sacrificed unto God. And everything was set in order. And all of the furniture was placed into the temple. And all of the implements were sanctified. And the priesthood was sanctified. And it was a glorious day throughout all Israel upon the completion of the temple. And not only was Solomon pleased, and certainly the people were pleased, but more important was the Lord's reaction to that which had been built, and we read about that in the 9th chapter, in the 3rd verse. The Lord told him, I have heard thy prayer and thy supplication that thou hast made before me. I have hallowed this house which thou hast built, to put my name there forever, and mine eyes and my heart shall be there perpetually. This was probably the peak of Solomon's rule. It was a time when he had shown everything to be as it ought to be, and he was being as he ought to be. And what he had done had not only brought the people to God, God was pleased with the things that he did. It was at this point that Solomon then embarked upon a rather extensive building program. He built palaces, he built government buildings, he built stables. And whereas the temple took 7 years to build, he spent 13 more years building some of these grand buildings throughout the city of Jerusalem. But herein also was the beginning of his downfall. As he built the buildings in Jerusalem, he also began to build temples. Other temples than to the temple of God. Temples to gods of foreign wives that he had taken unto himself, which, of course, was a horrendous error on his part. Because even though at this time, and probably throughout his lifetime, he never completely committed himself to idolatry, he showed a sympathy for it. He showed a compromise with it. He was willing to accommodate those who did not believe in God, but believe in the heathen and the paganism round about. And this, of course, was his downfall. That plus the fact that Solomon, though very wise, seems to just lavish the extravagance that he was able to afford. His throne was of ivory and of gold. He would display his wealth in a very proud fashion. The Bible says that silver became as stones in the city of Jerusalem because of his wealth. Now that's almost hard to imagine. And he would bring in and import all of these various exotic animals for his entertainment and to display his great abundance. In 1 Kings chapter 10, verses 23 beginning, it says, So King Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth for riches and for wisdom. And all the earth sought to Solomon to hear his wisdom which God had put in his heart. And they brought every man his present, vessels of silver and vessels of gold and garments and armor and spices, horses and mules, a rate year by year. Verse 27 says, And the king made silver to be in Jerusalem as stones, and cedars he made to be as the sycamore trees that are in the vale for abundance. Cedar was a very, very valuable lumber. Had to be brought down from the area of Lebanon, Tyre, and Sidon. He had so much of it, he was just like the bushes that you'd find round about. And he seemed to just glory in the lavish life that he lived and the abundance that he was able to display. But really Solomon's downfall was his marriage to foreign wives, and as we have mentioned, his participation in idolatry. In chapter 11, beginning with verse 4, it says, "For it came to pass, when Solomon was old, that his wives turned away his heart after other gods. And his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David." Verse 6, "And Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord, and went not fully after the Lord, as did David his father." And verses 9 and 10, "The Lord was angry with Solomon, because his heart was turned from the Lord God of Israel, which had appeared unto him twice, and had commanded him concerning this thing, that he should not go after other gods, but he kept not that which the Lord commanded." It's a shame when a man has been so blessed with things from God, then he allows his success to turn his head and to turn it away from the very source of his blessings. But that's what happened to Solomon. And he was told that the kingdom was going to be taken from him and from his family, not in his lifetime, but in the lifetime of his successor, at least a portion of the kingdom. The larger portion of the kingdom would be taken away from him. And so this was to come to pass in the days of Rehoboam, his son. And at this point in Solomon's career, whereas he had enjoyed peace, prosperity, adversaries began to arise, both from within and from without Israel. And his peace and tranquility of his rule ended. And it can only be summarized by saying, Solomon dissipated the greatness of Israel that he had partially inherited and that he had partially built. But having inherited the kingdom in a ripe condition from David and led it to a grandeur that was unsurpassed in his latter years, turning away from the true and living God, not being as faithful to him as he ought, he depleted Israel of its greatness. Among the adversaries that Solomon now has is a man named Jeroboam. Jeroboam was a very capable person. He was a man that's noted in the Bible for his leadership ability. He was a servant of Solomon. A prophet named Ahijah came to Jeroboam. He came to him with a garment, a new garment. And he cut that garment into 12 pieces. And he gave 10 of those 12 pieces to Jeroboam. These 12 pieces represented the 12 tribes of Israel. And 10 of the tribes were going to be given into the rule of Jeroboam. Now I emphasize Jeroboam because Solomon's son who succeeded him was named Rehoboam. And only 2 of the 12 tribes were going to continue with the family of David. Well, after this was done, Jeroboam became a fugitive because Solomon sought his death. And notice how things had so changed and so twisted. Solomon's father, David, had once had to be a fugitive, running for his life because of the hatred of King Saul against him. And David later became king, and Solomon became king, and now things had so changed that Solomon, David's son, is the one who is pursuing the fugitive. And Jeroboam is the one who is having to flee. After Solomon's death, Rehoboam, his son, becomes king. And Rehoboam certainly did not have the qualities of his father nor grandfather. And he proved himself to be so foolish. When he became king, the people came to him and made a very admirable and justifiable request. You keep in mind that Solomon became king and Solomon became great to a large extent on the backs of the people, having taken so much from them and having worked them so hard. And so the people came to Rehoboam and just simply asked in so many words, "Won't you lighten our burdens? Can't you make things easier for us?" And Rehoboam took it into consideration. And he called in some of the older and wiser people, those who had served with Solomon. Says, "What should I do with this request?" And their admonition was, and advice, "Listen to the people. Do what they wish. They will be loyal and faithful to you if you'll just sort of work with them and be considerate of them." Good advice. But he also called in some younger and more foolish advisors, those of his peers, who obviously did not understand nor were as considerate. He said, "Now what should I do with this request?" And they said, "Turn it down. Tell them that you're going to make things more difficult than ever before. That the loins of your father will be like your little finger. You haven't seen anything yet as to what it's going to be. And when he delivered and accepted that kind of advice and delivered that kind of answer to the people just rose up in rebellion against him. And you can understand why they would. They'd been just pressed too far. And so they began to follow the man Jeroboam. And 10 tribes pulled away from the leadership of Rehoboam. And now we have northern Israel and southern Judah. Rehoboam, of course, attempted to use force to recover the 10 tribes and to force them back under his rule, and God put a stop to that. And at this point, as we continue to read in 1 Kings, northern Israel is on center stage, and the focus is upon Jeroboam. Even though Jeroboam was a rebel, and even though he was the one to whom God allowed to have the 10 tribes, God made him certain promises. God gave him a great opportunity. God said, if you will serve me faithfully, I will establish you on the throne of these 10 tribes. Jeroboam didn't pay any attention to that. Jeroboam led the people into sin. He led the people into idolatry, where they served the wrong god. He set up altars for them to worship in Dan in the north and Beersheba, or Beersheba in the south part of northern Israel, which was the wrong place for worship, for Jerusalem was the designated place. He put as priests some of the lowest kind of people, people that were not even of the priestly tribe of Levi. He established his own feast days, other than the time and the type of feast days that the law of Moses called for. The Bible says that he did evil as he devised in his own heart. It is amazing to see how people then, and possibly even those of us now, having great opportunities afforded us, go our own way and do our own thing and turn our minds and hearts against God, but to our own destruction. As we continue to read in 1 Kings, it contains the record of certain events that took place under Jeroboam. We are impressed with that account of a prophet that came from Judah to the altar that Jeroboam had erected and pronounced God's curses against that altar. And Jeroboam told them to seize that man, doubtless to his destruction. But his arm was withered and paralyzed. And he asked the prophet to beseech or to intercede on his behalf and beseech God to return to him the use of his arm. And this was done. Jeroboam even invited that prophet to go home with him. The prophet refused on the basis that God told him to come up there, do his job, and go back home. But on the way back home, he was deceived by a false prophet who claimed to have received a special revelation from God, which he had not received. The prophet did not inquire of God whether it was true or not. The prophet told the good prophet that God had told him to come on back and it's all right to eat and be with me. It was a lie, but as people can, he believed a lie, and on his way home, he was destroyed. We also read of the death of Jeroboam's son. We read of even war that existed between the southern tribes of Judah and the northern tribes of northern Israel. You know, people, just think back. That was an unimaginable situation when they were crossing the Red Sea, when they were wandering in the wilderness, to think that that nation would be torn apart. When they were conquering the land of Canaan under Joshua, who would have ever thought that they would have rebelled and even gone to war against one another? That was something that would have been unheard of even in the time of the judges or the time of Saul. Certainly in the time of David and in the early part of Solomon's reign when the nation was at its greatest point. And now they had really blown it all away, to the point that they were divided into two nations, to the point that they even went to war against one another. As the book of 1 Kings begins to close, we start a rather lengthy record of kings, the kings of Judah and the kings of northern Israel. As we read in 1 Kings and as we go on into 2 Kings, there were some 20 people that occupied the throne in southern Judah, only 6 of which were commended as being righteous. There were 19 individuals that occupied the throne of northern Israel, not one of which was righteous in the sight of God. There were several different dynasties, several different families that ruled in northern Israel. In southern Judah, the king always came from the family of David. But we also read in 1 Kings of another great man, and that's the prophet Elijah. We'll not take the time to go into the various episodes and events of his life that are worth our study, particularly the time of the great contest that took place on Mount Carmel between Elijah and the 450 prophets of Baal, when he was trying to get the people to make a decision for God, saying, "How long halt ye between two opinions? If Baal be God, follow him. If God be God, then follow him." And the people answered him not a word. But he proceeded with a great contest to the proof and the evidence that God was the true and living God, and he persuaded the people to return to God, at least to some extent. The latter part of 1 Kings has to do with the reign of one of the most wicked men that ever put one foot in front of another on this earth, and that was Ahab, in consort with his evil wife Jezebel. It tells us of the injustices inflicted upon the man Naboth and the taking of his vineyard. We read also of Elijah's dealings with Ahab, of prophecies that were given concerning Ahab, concerning wars, concerning surrounding nations, and how eventually Elisha was to go and to anoint Elijah, was to go and anoint Elisha to be his successor. And the last chapters of 1 Kings tell us about the death of the wicked Ahab, even as he attempted to escape death by disguising himself, and the dog licking the blood at the very place where he had slain Naboth. When the book closes, there's a good king in southern Judah, Jehoshaphat. There's another wicked king in northern Israel, Ahaziah. And the history of these kings is continued in 2 Kings. Brethren, the value of this book is valuable to us for the history of Israel. It is valuable to us because it is another step and another link in the gradual unfolding of the scheme of redemption, the various things taking place that are bringing us closer and closer to Christ. It is of value to us because it helps us to understand the Bible and to be able to study it in its context, and to be able to see the continuing thread of unity that began all the way back from Genesis and goes all the way through all of the books of the Bible. It is one of the most demonstrative books of which Paul spoke in Romans 15:4, when he tells us whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning. So many demonstrations and examples of what to be and what not to be are found for us in 1 Kings. We have before us in this great history book of the Bible demonstrations and records of principles of what is right and what is wrong as God sees right and wrong. And this is the reason we are admonished by it. This is the reason we learn from it. This is the reason we spend our time meditating upon it. This is the reason we need to know it. Because having a knowledge of such material as is found in 1 Kings will help make me and make you a better servant of Christ in our own day.